Hello, Happy New Year, and welcome to You Really Shouldn't Have, with me, James Warwick. Each week, I sit down with a different guest to discuss their career and to discover the worst gift they've ever been given. Joining me on this episode is musician and songwriter Elliot Kennedy. Elliot is responsible for some of the 90s biggest pop hits, including Say You'll Be There from the Spice Girls, S Club 7's debut single Bring It All Back, and Boyzone's Picture of You, for which he won an Ivor Novello Award for. He joined to discuss his incredible career, his own upcoming album, and of course unwraps the story behind the worst gift he's ever been given. So Elliot, thanks so much for joining me on the show. It's really great to have you here.
It's a real pleasure, man. Thank you for asking me.
It's an honor to have you here. I can't wait to go through your incredible career. I mean, the list of songs that you've been involved in is mind-blowing, just looking through them all in preparation for this. I wanted to go right back to the beginning before we get there, because I know you were born in Sheffield, but I know you moved to Australia at quite a young age.
Yeah, I did. My parents were one of those, we were one of those 15 quid families at the time in the early 70s. You know, you either went to Canada or Australia or places like that, South Africa. We chose Australia. I remember at the time I was about four. And I remember being on the ship for what seemed like, I mean, it was entire length of the summer holidays, you know, it was 6 weeks to get there. Unbelievable. And I remember thinking my mum and dad had just moved on a ship. I kept thinking about this place called Australia, but didn't know what we were doing. It was an incredible experience, but of course my childhood was, I can't even remember wearing shoes. It was one of those, the childhoods that was incredible. And not, you know, just before my mum died, I remember talking to her about when I was a kid. We used to go out into the bush, which was opposite our house, in actual fact. I used to walk down this big water pipeline down the side of the mountain to the river. And we'd be out there with no shoes on and with the deadliest creatures in the world. And I said to my mum, how could you let me do this? I mean, I've got kids now. I also never let them do it. And she just looked at me stunned and she said, I never knew you did that. So we had this sort of secret childhood. It was brilliant, though. It was a fantastic place to grow up.
So when did your interest in music first begin? Was it something you pursued during your school years?
You know what, my dad was a singer, and he, you know, in the north here we have working men's clubs. I know they have similar things all over the country. In Australia they had RSL clubs, which is a very similar thing, but a sports club. And so he used to do cabaret, he did a bit of telly, you know, as a singer. So I used to go to his gigs and obviously sit in his dressing room because I wasn't allowed out and to watch the show. I'd sit there with pop and crisps and listen to my dad. And for whatever reason, I was able to go home and play the songs he was singing on a keyboard. I wasn't taught, I was just able to play it. So it was a bit of an odd thing. We had this electric organ, and my dad said, how are you able to do that? And he sort of, you know, took it seriously, got me some piano lessons. So it was a strange thing, but I actually share this with Gary Barlow, that we found that listening to those old standards, those classic songs that my dad used to sing, because in working men's clubs and stuff and cabarets, they just sing what was in the charts at the time. And of course, in the 70s, they're all just what we now refer to as classics. It sort of taught me, and Gaz feels the same way, it sort of taught you how great songs were written by learning the structure and, you know, how to construct a song like that, the relationship between melody and chord and bass and stuff. So it was actually an incredible education. So my teachers were these classic records of the time.
And when did the interest in songwriting come to you?
Sure, I remember being 8 years old and saving up for a record that I'd heard a little bit on the radio of. It was a French techno band called Telex. I was eight. This is 1977. And I'd watch, you know, Star Wars had just come out and Jaws was in the cinema. This was the era, right? And this French techno band were on the radio. I remember just thinking the sound of synthesizers. I didn't know what they were. I couldn't believe the sounds. So then coming back to the UK, which we did when I was about 12. So I went out straight into high school. And, you know, Howard Jones, Depeche Mode were the bands. I was so into synths. We didn't have any money. Mom and dad didn't have anything. We were just a regular working class family, and I couldn't afford it. So I used to beg and borrow, you know, synthesizers wherever I could to learn how to play these things. And that was the beginning of it. And it turned out that I had a cousin who was a musician. He was a bass player, and he had a bit of equipment in his apartment. He was studying to be a PhD student. And so I learned this, that I'd never met this guy. He was my cousin who was a musician. That was it then. I used to go there every weekend, and we'd do the, we actually made an album. He taught me how to record on a little Porter studio. And that was it. And I just, all I wanted to do was write songs. So anyone from school reminds me as the guy that was always at the piano every break and lunchtime, just learning, writing songs. Most of them were terrible, of course, but you start somewhere, and that was where I started.
Was music always on the agenda for you when you left school?
Yeah, do you know, it's interesting, actually. I have a fantastic story about this. So my last year of school, my careers meeting, you know, you go for that meeting, they talk about what you want to do and they give you some advice. I went to school in Dinnington, a little mining town in the 80s, you know, where miners strike and all the rest of it. There weren't many options for kids in my school. And my careers meeting was quite simply like this. I went in there, the guy said to me, right, which pit do you want to go down, Dinnington or Maltby? And I looked at him and I said, oh, no, I want to be a songwriter. And he sort of looked at me and went, very nice, Dinnington or Maltby. So that was, they were my options. Unbelievable. But on the very last day of school, the school, we'd done a gig and raised some money for school funds, and they let us spend it on some music equipment. So we bought a Porter studio, a drum machine, a synth, worst thing they could have ever let me do, because that's all I did for my last year. I'd go in at 8:30 in the morning and go, oh, let me just have a listen to what I did yesterday. I'd look at my watch and it was R4. You know, literally days would go by and they just thought I was sick or something. But on the last day of school, I remember mixing my album, and I was on backstage where they had a cassette deck, and sat there with my Porter studio, my headphones, and I turned around and there was the headmaster, and he's a big dude, you know, Mr. Forster. It's always Mr. His name's Gordon, but he's always Mr. Forster in it. And there he was, stood there looking at me, and he went, can I have a listen? And I sort of gave him the headphones like this, and he went, this is really good. I said, thank you. He said, Elliot, what are you doing next year? And I said, well, I'm planning to come back to sixth form. And he just looked at me and he went, why? And I said, what? And he went, Elliot, look around you. These kids don't know what they want to do. He says, you know exactly what you want to do. What are you waiting for? I mean, just go out there and get on with it. And you know what? It's the best advice I've ever had in my life. A teacher, the headmaster, telling me to leave school. I went out and did it. I got a job as a T-boy in a studio. This is how you're meant to learn, you know, start as an intern or whatever. And I learned the craft of engineering and writing songs and all the rest of it. I did a school gig not so long ago to raise some funds for that school. And I went back and took some friends and sang all my hits. It was a great night. And I found him. I invited him to the gig. And halfway through the show, I got him up on stage and I gave him a Spice Girls multi-platinum award album.
Wow.
And so, you know what? This Celine Dion, Aretha Franklin, Bryan Adams songs, they wouldn't have existed if you hadn't, on this very stage, told me to go on and get on with my life. He was in tears. It was a highly emotional moment, but it was this fantastic completion of this circle that started on that very stage. And I was able to complete it brilliantly in front of the same guy, just to say thanks for being that guy. Everyone has their favorite teacher. Mine was my headmaster telling me to go out and get out of school.
It's fantastic. That's a brilliant story. Your first number one record was Everything Changes for Take That. What do you remember of that experience in meeting the guys and writing that song?
It's quite funny, actually, because I was a jobbing engineer. Okay, that's how I was earning money, recording the Weekend Warriors at the studio. You know, the rock bands. They always used to come from Barnsley, which is I didn't understand. But anyway, I got quite a name for myself doing death metal records. I don't know why. I just knew how to record a drum kit well, and I sort of made death metal records. We mixed them like I like to hear pop records, you know, and. I'd got, all of a sudden, made an album that was a number one death metal album. The very same week, my record with Lulu entered the top 10.
Oh, wow.
I was at number 10 with Lulu and number one in the death metal charts. I didn't tell the death metal band that. I thought I might lose my cred. But it started a chain of events because Nigel Martin Smith, who managed to Take That, listened to it. He was a fan of Lulu's and said to Gary, whoever's made this album, so she sounds amazing, we should get him to work with us. So I got a phone call. Do you want to work with Take That? And the next thing was a phone call. Hello, I'm Gary Barlow here. Is that Elliot? We're coming to work with you. And that was it. Me and Gaz became best mates, and we still are. We talk to each other every day. And my impression of him's getting better. But that's, we wrote Everything Changes in that first sitting. And do you know what? I always had the ambition to have a number one by the time I was 25. And freakishly, Everything Changes went to number one on my 25th birthday.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it seemed unbelievable. It was an incredible party, I can tell you that much.
I bet it was. Now, you mentioned the Spice Girls earlier, and Say You'll Be There was the big song you wrote with them. But how did that all come to be? I know there's a bit of a story there.
Yeah, and do you know what? After Everything Changes, I had a couple of other hits, and I actually freaked out a little bit. I actually felt a bit of a phony. I really wanted to be a great songwriter, and I felt like I was sort of flying by the seat of my pants, if I'm honest. I didn't really feel like I knew what I was doing. So I asked my manager and I asked my publisher, Sony, would they support me if I put a little studio at home. I actually bought my mum and dad's house off them. They wanted a bungalow, and you know, they're getting older. So I bought their house because they had a little extension on the back, and only a little semi in, you know, Sheffield. And but I could put my gear in there and work from home. And I said to Martin, my manager, look, I know this is a risk. I know it means I'm not going to be working with people, but I just want to shut the doors and spend a year like learning my craft as a songwriter. And then I feel like I could take on anything. And he said, okay, fair enough. Now at that point, I'd asked to be, to go to London, meet this guy who had got an artist they wanted to talk to me about. And I went to see him, and this was Chris Herbert, and he was managing another artist, and he played around. I was like, I said, yeah, it's all right. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Do you manage anyone else? You know? And he said, well, we've got these five girls. Yeah, it's not quite ready yet. You know, it's like a pop R&B thing, but it's not ready for you yet. And I said, really? So it sounds awesome. Fire girl band. I've just done boy bands, you know. Let me work with them. And if it goes well, I'll work with the other artist. And they went, okay. So we put a date together. The night before that session, I called Martin and said, I haven't heard about these girls tomorrow. Do you know anything about it? And he said, no, but if they cancel, they'll have to pay for the cancellation of the studio. I booked a studio for it, you know. Anyway, later on that night, I was in another studio doing another session, and I got a phone call. I'd got one of those big old brick phones, you know, with the big areas. And when it vibrated, you really knew about it. The whole building shook. And it was the guy from the studio that I'd booked, and he said, hey, it's Dave here from Fond. There's two girls here that need to talk to you about from a girl band you're working with. So I said, oh, who is it? And it was Jerry and Mel B. And Jerry said, look, we need to see you. We've got to talk to you. So I gave him the address where they came up. And she said, look, I know this is awkward, but we're sacking our manager tomorrow. He won't let us work with anyone. And we've decided to leave. We've left the house and we're firing him. And we wanted to find you because we really want to work with you. He wouldn't give us your number. So we've just turned up to Sheffield to find you. And I said, what? She said, well, we thought we'd look you up in the phone book. I said, I'm not in the phone book. I said, well, we realized that 5 or 6 hours ago. So we just called every studio until we could find you. I said, you know what? That's dedicated. I said, look, I don't even know your manager. Of course, I'm going to continue working with you. So he was like, great. Is there anywhere for us to stay? So that was it. Overnight, five sisters descended on me, which might sound like a fun time, but I can tell you, we had the best time. They crashed over. They had no money. I had to give them money for petrol and feed them and take them for pizza and whatever else. But oh my goodness, did we have a great time? It was absolutely brilliant. At times a bit hairy. They got on each other's nerves a bit. I was relegated to the settee. So that was my, you know. But do you know what? Jerry and I started a fantastic friendship that continues. I love that girl. I love all of them. They're incredible girls. And they went out. We wrote these fun songs. We had a brilliant time in my house. And they went out and literally changed the world. You know, one of those songs was Say You'll Be There.
Now, we've reached the part of the show, Elliot, where I have to ask you, what is the worst gift you've ever been given?
Do you know what? I've had a few, but the worst gifts were always given to me by my sister. My sister, I don't know if you ever saw that amazing series, This Is England. Yes. And it's just fantastic. There's a brilliant scene in it when the young, when he, in the first series, when the young lad wants a pair of Dockers to be a skinhead, and his mum doesn't want him to get Dockers and takes him to this shop. And the shopkeeper clocks what the mum's doing, and she gives him this other nasty pair of boots and says, "Yeah, but these are from London." Like that made all the difference. My sister used to do this all the time, but she used to buy the worst. Especially for the kids, in particular my daughter, I remember once she bought a dressing gown and a nightie, and she wanted to see them on, and it was so cheap and nasty that it actually gave off sparks, and I was worried that she was going to get set, burst into flames at this point. I'd turn around and went, "What is this?" She went, "It's not cheap, you know, they've come from London." Like, it makes a difference where they come from. But then, I remember also she bought my son a car, and it looked impressive, and she turned it on and all the lights were flashing and stuff, and then incredibly loud and distorted was that record, "Calling Mr. Wrong, calling me." It's really loud, blaring out of this thing, and I looked at her and I went, "What are you thinking?" It lasted about 5 minutes. I think I put my foot through it. But the worst one, this was the funniest. We got some relatives that my mum was so old fashioned. She used to have those Capodimonte ornaments in her house. You know, those old fashioned like dancing ladies and stuff. And I used to take the mick out of them all the time. But my relatives who would see these on them thought I liked them. So when I first got married, bought me some of these Capodimonte ornaments, which of course we laughed at. I thought, "What are we going to do with these?" But they're the kind of people that might just descend on you one Sunday afternoon. So we kept them in a little box next to the settee. And anytime I saw them, "Quick, get them out!" We put them on the mantelpiece. So they come, "Oh, look, oh, yeah, I've got your ornaments." "Oh, yeah, we love them, yeah." So one time I went out and I came back to find their car in the drive. And I'd not prepped my partner about this. So I came in and looked, and they weren't up on the mantelpiece. And I could see her stood there, sort of sitting there, a bit confused. And I said to my partner, "Have you told them about the break-in?" And she went, "Oh, no, no." I said, "Oh, yeah, we were burgled." I said, "They only took what looked expensive. Obviously, you can see they took all the Capodimonte and took a couple of other things. But I must have scared them off because the wires were all out of the back of the telly, but they didn't take the I styled it out somehow. Total fudge. But I managed to get around the fact that... But thankfully, we were able to throw them out because... Hold on, I'm telling you this. They might be hearing. What am I doing?
When it comes to writing the songs, do you get the melody down first, or do you often get like ideas for lyrics and think, let's find something to fit the lyrics?
Funny one, I'm a bit of an all-rounder, so I can play, and I play a few instruments, and I'm a singer, as you probably know, and a lyricist. So it depends who I'm working with, because sometimes you work with people who are just track, they're just like musicians, you know, and chord people or whatever, or track people. Other times you work with someone who's a dedicated lyricist or a top-line writer, a melody writer. So I play the other role and supply the music and accompaniment. It's an odd one. When I work with Gary, for instance, we both sort of do the same things. So we tend not to sit in the same studio together for very long. Even we've written a Broadway musical together. I think we might have actually been in the room two or three times, because we can finish each other's sentences, let alone sandwiches. So we take an idea, I'll show it anywhere, Elle, you take that and work on it. Take that and work on it, no pun intended. I would go off and come home and start with, when I got fed up with it, I'd send it to him. And because we use the same software and very similar kind of approach, it would come up on his computer, he'd tell right and middle eight and send it back to me or change the chorus. And it's one of those things where we try to surprise each other nowadays with like changes and different keys and things just to keep it interesting. But we literally think the same way. It's a bit scary. But it's always fun working together, but it's a waste of time being in the same room. So we tend to do this a lot, you know, whereas other writers, you really need to sort of connect and be in the room, and it's all about energy. So it changes. Sometimes it's a title. In Nashville, for instance, you go to work in Nashville. First time I ever worked in Nashville, you go in a room with a guy, he turns up with his guitar, and he sits there and opens a book and looks at you and says, "So, what are your titles, man?" And you go, "Mister? doctor, I've got an honorary doctorate. No, man, what are your titles? He's got pages and pages of song titles, and you choose one and you go, write a song about this. Actually, funnily enough, Gaz got into that. That's how Everything Changes came about, because he had Everything Changes and I put but you in brackets. That's how that's. So it's funny. Sometimes the stars are might be something you've heard in a film. I remember talking to Brian Adams about this and that song, Have You Ever Really Loved a Woman? And the killer line, when you see your unborn children in her eyes. I said, well, who came up with that winner? And he went, it was a line in the script. No one hears it, but it's actually just a line in the script. So it could be anything that sets you off, a title, something you read in a book. It's the beauty of being a songwriter. And I always say that my philosophy about this is that I happen to be holding a pencil the day the universe wants to write a song. That's what it feels like. I feel like a conduit for this energy, and you might be sat at a piano with a guitar, and when those, you've just got to be ready to receive. That's my philosophy.
Did you ever write songs with an artist in mind and think, I'm going to pitch this song to, say, Brian Adams? Or do you wait until you meet the artist and then think, oh, well, what's going to work for this particular act?
Mostly I was like a hired gun by the label, you know. So, for instance, Simon Cowell, Darling, I need a hit for five. And that was it, you know, and I'd go and see him and meet the band or whatever. And he'd play me a song and I'd go, all right, I'm going to do some whatever I want, you know, as a follow-up. And sort of do my thing. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Actually, the great thing about working with Simon is you always know where you stood, because you just say, it's a smash, Darling. And that's it, you were out of the room, you know. But it's been a fantastic opportunity, of course, to meet people. But most of the time, it was just like, pitch a song for an artist. I would always choose to meet them first and get an idea on who they are, because the thing I've always wanted to do is never repeat myself, you know, and never be that guy that only does this or does that. So I've always been really proud of being able to go from Brian Adams to Spice Girls to Celine Dion to, you know, Boyzone in the same year, and not repeat myself and just make it about them. You know, that's been the job of a songwriter and a producer. It's their record, not my record, which has made it really odd making my own album, because I've had to do the complete opposite. Yeah, that's the weird thing. But mostly it's actually either writing specifically with the artist or being asked by the label to write something specifically for someone, you know.
You mentioned Simon there, and I wanted to touch a bit on when you worked with Gary on X Factor in 2011, because I know you worked on that series as an artist consultant, like a development role for this show. And with all your work with bands, it would be quite apt that it was the first season that a band won. It was a Little Mix, wasn't it?
Oh, irony you say that. I was hired because a band had never won, and I understood why. I had an angle on why. And the funny thing was, Gaz's wife Dawn wouldn't let him do that show if I didn't do it with him, because she knew I'd look after him. And we had just the best time. It was so much fun. The producers were really lovely to me. But I had an idea on why a band had never won, and that being that in 2 minutes, the 2 minute performance that they have on X Factor is great for a solo artist, but terrible for a band. And what we knew from working with the Spice Girls is that they appealed to five different demographics, five fan bases in one band. And they really worked the differences. They celebrated the uniqueness of each artist in that band. And it meant that they covered so many young girls as a result, you know, that I want to be Baby Spice, I want to be Ginger Spice. So with bands, it meant you needed to get your personality over, and 2 minutes is tough. But what Little Mix understood, and you know, they were four solo artist rejects that waited until the very last, and we said, would you mind working together? And they, it was the last band I saw on the boot camp day, and we were in a hotel. I was knackered, I was going home, it was 1 a.m. in the morning, and Jesse was there, oh, don't forget about us, and they wouldn't let him sing in the hotel because everyone was trying to get sleep. So we had to go over to the gym. And they prepared something to sing to me. And I stood there and went, oh, my God. I rang Gary and I rang Kelly Rowland. And I said, guys, I think I've just heard the best thing we've got on this show. They're incredible. They came the next day and the girls sang for them. I remember thinking, and I talked to them. I said, look, I've got an angle on why. I said, so here's the deal. Before your performance, there is a 2 minute VT. Which means when we're in the house, and I lived in the house with all the contestants, which was absolute chaos. Brilliant. I said to the girls, every time you see a camera, it counts towards that 2 minutes. So Perry, you've got to be Perry from Little Mix. Jesse, you've got to be Jesse from Little Mix all the time. I remember Gaz and the boys telling me back in the day, Nigel was so strict. If Mark went out for milk, he had to look like Mark Owen from Take That. He had to have his hair done. He had to look the part. Do you know what I mean? He was so strict about making sure that that image, that perception was always carried. So I said to them, just be who you are every time you see a camera. I'm not telling you to be false. I'm telling you to be yourself, but be yourself, your full-on personality. They absolutely got that. And with the help of all of us development people, they listened and worked really, really hard. I can't say that for Frankie Kokoza, who was on the same series.
Oh, of course.
Janet Devlin did. She was an absolute sweetheart and has gone on to make records. I actually made a rap album with her. I adore that girl. I actually wrote one of my favorite songs with her. And a few of the others, Craig Colton was really good on that year. There were some fun artists, but the girls, Marcus, who made it to the final, was a super solo artist. But the girls really listened. They really got it. So we had the best time doing it. I'm so, so proud of them. And I'm so worried about Jessie, because I know she's not on top form right now. She's taking some time out. So, you know, God bless you, Jessie. You're an amazing singer. You know, if you hear this, I'm praying for you.
Absolutely. More recently, Elliot, you've taken the move to be in front of the microphone. We mentioned your album and your solo career a little bit earlier on, but I know you released your single My Destiny a couple of months back. So I wanted to know what the process was like of producing your own songs, and did that differ at all from all of the years of work with other artists?
It started on my birthday. I had a big birthday party, my 50th, I don't mind admitting. And I invited a load of artists that I've had hits with. Take That turned up, you know, Heather Small and Alfie Bowe and Kenny Thomas and a few others. S Club came. It was a brilliant night. 2,500 people singing happy birthday to you. It was the most humbling thing I've ever experienced. And it was a brilliant night. But I went on to start the gig. And Gaz and Mark and Alfie Bowe and Heather, they were all in my dressing room listening on the speaker. And I went on to start the gig and opened up with Sabie there and a couple of other hits. And apparently Alfie said to Gaz, "Who's this singing?" And Gaz said, "It's Elle. What do you think we're doing here?" He went, "I didn't know he was a singer." So afterwards, Gaz called me and went, "Elle, you've got to make an album, mate." And I went, "Give over." And he went, "Elle, You do these gigs. I come and do it," because I drag him to every charity event going, poor lad. And he comes and does. He's always amazing, of course. And he said, "Elle, I've done these gigs with you and you sell them out. People, you have fans. People know who you are from the work we've done together, from all your hits. You should make an album for them." I just thought he was nuts. So I said, "All right, whatever." Anyway, a couple of weeks later, I went to see the boys on tour, and he'd arranged for me to meet an agent. And I went, "What is up with you?" And he went, "Elle, I'm not leaving it, mate. I'm not. You've got to do an album. You've got to do an album. I want you to do a tour." So I thought it was nuts. Anyway, this year happens, 2020 happens to us. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to do it now, when else am I going to do it? You know, and Gaz said to me, "Elle, what else can we do? There's no gigs. There's no telly we can do properly that we would normally do." He says, "You're in the same boat as me. You've got, you know, social media." He says, "Get off your ass, make your record and start promoting." And I thought, well, all right, let's have a go and see what happens. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed doing it. But when doing it, I always realized that for an artist to do what they need to do for their fans, and I learned this with Brian, I learned it with Celine Dion, they've got to do what is real to them, what's actually they believe in, that they, when they sing it, it sounds honest. Honesty is everything. That's what connects a song with a human being. It's about, you know, the energy transfer of emotion. So I've always thought, and I thought, well, if I was to make an album, what would I do? And what I grew up with is referred to as sort of yacht rock, that sort of late 70s. Someone summed it up for me as saying it's like when men were able to sing emotional songs for the first time. So being in Australia, it was a Little River Band, but it was Doobie Brothers and a Hall & Oates and, you know, Steely Dan. So all of those influences ought to make me who I am as a musician. That's what I love to listen to. So I've made an album called A Yacht Named Sue, as a bit of a head nod to that sort of era. And the single is My Destiny. I'm just actually planning the video for the second single. So it's been great hearing My Destiny on Radio 2 and various other radio stations, and people seem to like it. They say I sound like Michael McDonald, which is fantastic company to be in. But it's been a thrill ride, mate. I'm absolutely loving it.
Fantastic. And what can we expect from you in 2021?
So 1st of January, my new single comes out, which is called When Love Breaks Down. I wrote it with John Reed from the Nightcrawlers, who's a fantastic singer. He sang the demo, so I've had to try and copy him. He's an amazing singer. But I've done my own version of it. It's very yacht. It's got that sort of vocal harmony thing going on. It's more of a ballad, but it's a pretty powerful one. It's quite emotional. So yeah, When Love Breaks Down comes out on January the 1st. So we'll get Christmas out of the way and all the Christmas songs will be ready for something new. But I'm excited about it. We're actually spending a bit of time on the video of this one. The last one was I did a launch gig, live launch gig on Facebook, and it was great. Lots of people watched it and commented on it. I had a live band in the studio, all socially distanced, which was awesome. So this one, I'm actually going to take a little bit of time and do the video. The wonderful people at Sheffield City Hall are giving me the City Hall, which will be empty, to do this song, which is all about isolation, about, you know, what it feels like when your love is breaking down. So it's going to be fun. I'm looking forward to doing it. But yeah, 1st of January for the next single.
If you had to go right back to the beginning of your career and give yourself a gift to help to get where you are now, what gift would you give yourself?
You know what? I would have given myself a harmonica. I love the sound. You know, you hear someone who really plays the harmonica. It's been one of those things throughout my life. I thought, if I played that, I'd put it on so many records. You know, and they're very difficult to find a harmonica player. We found one once, me and Gaz found one, and it was hilarious because we thought he could play it really well. It was absolutely terrible. It was and we had to sort of sit there and style it out for a session. But I remember thinking throughout the years, I've even bought myself harmonicas and never had the time to sort of get into it because, of course, by this point, I'm full on making records. But I think as a young person, I'd have given myself a harmonica and said, learn that, you'll be end up being a pretty busy session player. That is probably the gift I wish I'd given to myself.
And finally, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
So it's all online right now on every platform. My Destiny is out as a single. Of course, it's on the videos on YouTube. And then the album will be out in the first quarter of next year, an album called A Yacht Named Sue. There'll be a further single, I hope. But yeah, it's all out there. And you know, I'm so thankful for the support I've had, radio and people online. So I'm just going to keep doing it. And as soon as we're back in the world, I can't wait to get out and play. I can't wait to do gigs. So we're going to do as many gigs as we can as soon as we can.
Fantastic. Well, Elliot, it's been great to have you here. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of You Really Shouldn't Have. Be sure to subscribe to us on your chosen podcast service to make sure you never miss another episode. You can find us on both Twitter and Instagram at Bad Gifts Pod, as well as online at badgiftspod.com.